Hi, this is Phil Lairness, sitting alongside my wife, Lily Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. Why do you have that glazed expression on your face, Lil?
Too many numbers in that announcement.
Music, thoughts, hopes, and dreams. Four terrific ingredients for the East Coast's latest audio offering, with singer-songwriter Pamela Sue Mann and Alex Levchuk opening an audacious audio assembly of talent for New York. Real talk.
I'm staring out the window. You call me on the phone. Another situation. Another night alone. Like a gray sky with no rain. Sun won't shine through. No one makes me crazy. Like you do.
Talk. And clearly, we've got a genuine New Yorker with us, two residents of New York. I'll start by congratulating Pamela Sue Mann, because you got a new mayor. Eric Adams has taken over the mayoral duties at New York City. So did you vote? Was he your choice? I mean, is it a case of celebrate and rejoice this cleaner son who's risen to be mayor of New York?
May I default Stu for this?
Well, that makes sense. Let's go to a person who was born and raised in Coney Island, Brooklyn. Oh, yeah. He is a genuine New Yorker. He's got so many awesome material. We welcome to, of course, New York Real Talk and indirectly the Madrid Drive. It's a Studio Stu, otherwise known, of course, as the awesome Stuart and indeed Brooklyn legend. How are you, Stuart?
I'm doing great. Great. How you doing, Alex?
Yeah, we're okay. I mean, and genuinely just saying those words, how are you doing? It's like New York writ large. It's great. Yes,
and I just talk that way. You know, everybody tells me I have an accent, but I think everybody else has the accent, you know.
That's true. It's the sort of thing somebody who says creativity comes in spurts. Throughout your life, you find yourself floating through different creative careers, would actually say. Words taken from your very own website, of course, studiostu.com.
Yeah, well, that's the truth. You know, I've gone through many different configurations in my creative career. I actually started as a photographer, came right out of college, photography major. Actually, I was in England. I got my undergraduate degree at Newcastle University. It was actually Newcastle Polytechnic at the time.
In which case, it'd be the University of Northumbria these days.
Exactly, so yeah.
It all connects.
It does all connect. So I came out, you know, I've always been a musician since I was born and raised. But I found the photography really to be something that excited me coming out of college. So I went into photography doing actually music photography, being on the road, doing album covers, things like that.
Well, we're going to find out some of the fantastic things you have done. But it's interesting, as I say, just for the geographers amongst you, obviously Lincoln Performing Arts Centre behind me, about 156 miles south of Newcastle. And Newcastle about 40 miles north of where I live up in Middlesbrough. So just shows, which is pretty much, I suppose, really just the length of the state of New York, really, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, I used to go to a college called Fredonia, which is about 480 miles from New York City. So it would be an 8-hour drive. I don't even think I could drive 8 hours in England.
You could, believe me, you could. You might not Can want you? To, but you could. You could certainly be in the car for that whole side of things. And of course, we do have those things that I know Americans all love, the roundabout. It's a you phenomenon. It. You know?
We just had a couple put up here in Kingston. I'm living in Kingston, New York, right this second. And people have no clue what to do when they come to a roundabout. You know, they see a space and they think they can go in, but they don't realize there's a yield kind of thing going on.
This is a real breaking news story. Roundabouts in New York. I mean, talk about the Brits are coming. Wow.
Yeah, it doesn't work. There's no mentality for that because there's no courtesy. So, you know, who's going to let somebody come in? Really?
We'll hand over to Pamela in a few seconds because it is her show, of course. It is New York Real Talk. But I've got to ask the question at the moment, Stu. Is this a genuine quote that you were actually thrown out of the Sandy Lane Accordion School for? And the quote is, playing notes during orchestra rehearsal that didn't exist.
That was exactly what Sandy Lane himself had told me. I was about probably 8 years old. The accordion in the 50s, that was the instrument du jour. You know, everybody got an accordion. And I just never heard, you know, I didn't understand at that age that there was an A part, a B part, and a C part in an orchestra. I wanted to play melody. In fact, I wanted to play over the melody. So during a song, I would just start improvising, basically. And they didn't really like that. That doesn't really go well in an orchestra.
You see, I was initially confused because I thought, was it actually the orchestra that didn't exist? Was it the orchestra rehearsal that didn't exist? Was it an existential crisis you were suffering? Or was it just indeed, as you've just described, the notes?
I think it was all three of those, you know. I think it was all three of those. I was having an existentialist crisis of playing the wrong notes at the wrong time in an orchestra situation, which is why I became a jazz player, because that's where improv belongs.
Okay, Pamela, over to you.
I was just thinking of a joke, but I couldn't frame it in the right way, but it has something to do with someone burgling an accordion player's car. But instead of taking the accordion, he when the accordion player got back to his car, there were 10 accordions.
You're right. Yeah, that's a joke. It's like this thief broke into my car. I had my accordion in there. When I got down on my car, there were 10 more accordions in.
It could have been worse, Stu. You could have been playing the triangle or the kazoo.
Yeah, and I could definitely improv those easily.
Oh, kazoo is wonderful. I think that the kazoo has really not had its proper renaissance. And I'm going to think, maybe Stu and I should think about this.
Yeah. Next album, Pamela, I expect the kazoo to be featured.
For sure. For sure.
Well, you know, I would like to just say that Alex has taught me a new term.
Okay.
Called polymath. Am I saying it right? Polymath.
Absolutely.
And Stu definitely fits into the category of polymath. I don't even remember how I first met him. I don't remember how, but it seems like we've always known each other.
Yeah.
And he used to play, we used to play together.
In your band.
Yes. And play the strangest instrument, which I will let him explain exactly what it was, but it was sort of a washtub bass made out of fishing string or something, but it was a phenomenal instrument. And we used to play together in these strange little shows that we would just sort of create the venue because it didn't exist upstate and people were just like, what are you doing? And then I remember one night, and I have to tell this story, and then I'm going to just turn it over to Stu because I'd really like to know what he'd like to talk about. Stu, I'm wondering if you remember this. So I was about 6 months pregnant. It was one of my last shows I played musically before my daughter was born.
323 West Broadway.
Oh, my goodness. And Stu and I went, he drove me down very graciously, me and my very pregnant self. And we did this show. And after the show, I think Stu said, hey, do you want to go to Gray's Papaya? Which is an institution in New York. I'm not sure if they're still there. I think they might
one
be.
That's more. Another one left.
What, one more left? The one we went to?
That one is not there anymore. That was 86th Street on the east side, I believe.
Right. Okay. So we went to Gray's Papaya, and I was being super healthy because I didn't want to damage my daughter. And I was, you know, drinking herbal teas, no caffeine, no booze, like nothing except deli meat. I was craving deli meat. But other than that, I was completely organic, healthy, obnoxious mother-to-be. And I said to Stu, you know, what can I get at Gray's Papaya? I really don't want a smoothie. Yeah. I said, I'm really craving a hot dog, and they're well known for their hot dogs. And I was really torn about it because, you know, it's kind of processed. And I just said, Stu, do you think that the baby would like a hot dog? And Stu said, in only a way that Stu can say, are you kidding? The baby will love a hot dog.
And look how good she turned out.
And she loves hot dogs.
That's why, because you had them when you were pregnant.
Well, I mean, creatively, clearly that's it. You actually go for the next album will be entitled Would the Baby Like a Hot Dog, featuring Stu on kazoo.
Yes, Stu on kazoo. Wow, that's a good one. I must write that down.
Stu on kazoo. Very good one, I have to say. So Stu, I think the overarching statement / question is, you know, you have done so many things so well. You're even an efficient, and you even marry people.
Sure.
To each other, not to you.
Yeah. Well, I love marrying people. You could ask both my ex-wives.
How has it been in your life in terms of, have you ever felt like, oh no, I have to only do one thing and focus on that? Or have you just sort of done the thing that calls to you at the moment?
Well, I think that has been the main problem, that I've never been able to focus on just one thing. I've always thought, well, I'm a creative person, so why limit myself to one thing? I think when I met you, I was still had one foot in photography at the time. I was a filmmaker. I went through my music career. I became a marriage officiant. I do cannabis medicine. I mean, there's so many ways to create. That why would you limit yourself to one? I don't find any difference between making a painting and making music, or making a film and creating photography. It's all the same creative decisions go into it. So you just make it happen, you know?
I believe it forms a more well-rounded brain. And I'd really like to ask Alex what his thoughts are, that because I know that you do speak with people often who are multifaceted. And I do think that it does grow the different branches of the brain when you're taking on different disciplines and you're growing yourself and expressing yourself in those different ways. What do you think about that, Alex?
I think just looking at Studio Stew, Unusual Solutions, you can see the range there from the Outside the Mud Club. You mentioned the marriage, the Insta book, the I Think section, the music section. As spiritual beings on a human experience, I think it does actually help to diversify. And it's the old R. Buckminster Fuller line of synergy, where you put two apparently disparate ideas together, you get a synergistic third idea emerging as if by magic that may or may not like hot dogs. It's part of the wondrousness of life.
Yeah. I mean, you can do anything, but you can't do everything. So you choose the exact things that are going to sustain your life, that are going to enhance your life, that are going to make things better for you and for the people around you. You know, if you do somebody's portrait and they love it, they get happy. You do a great show, you make them laugh, you show them great music, they get happy. You marry somebody, that's the happiest moment in their lives. Little do they know, but it is the happiest moment at that moment in their lives. And so, you know, we as creatives are really involved in making people happy. I think that's part of it.
Previous years on the Midweek Drive, we featured an iconic New York cab driver called Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. You may have heard of him. He does yellow taxi cab, does various other things. You, of course, are a genuine New York icon, Stu. And I think this line of how you actually were performing on the subway platforms in New York, doing only the tune Take the A Train. Was that a deliberate policy? You could have had Last Train to Clarksville. You could have had Midnight Train to Georgia. There are lots of other train stories you've actually gone through, but you stuck for Take the A Train.
Oh, we're swinging. Okay. Do ya do da do ya da? Do do da do ya do da? Da 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 do ya do ba ba.
Get on board, it's coming. Can't you feel them wheels a-thrumming? All on board. Get on the A train and you will find you missed the quickest way to Harlem, baby. Harlem, hurry, get on board, it's coming. can't you feel them wheels a-thrummin'? All on board, get on the A-train, you will find, and you'll find the quickest way to Harlem. And you'll find the quickest way to Harlem.
Yeah, well, the reason for that, that was actually the transition moment where I was like going to leave photography and start my music career. It was really a late time. I was 40, 41 at the time. So it wasn't like I was a kid.
Long past starting. It, basically, well over the age of 30. And
I just moved back from Puerto Rico. I was teaching photography in the university with my son and my ex-wife. And I needed to actually make a living. So I had a washtub base. Literally a washtub with a stick and a string. And I went into the subway, 34th Street Station on the A train line, and dressed in a suit, tie, hat, and did take the A train. Now there's 3,000 people out there listening. Oh, that's so funny. I'm in New York. There's a guy singing the A train. Here comes the A train. Then they throw money at you. They get on the train. There's 3,000 new people. You know, people always said, what did you do today? I was like, well, I performed for 250,000 people. They said, 250? I said, yeah. In 4 hours, there were 250,000 people went past me. So, yeah, that's how I did it. And I started making a living. The next thing I knew, I was, you know, playing in jazz clubs. I had an agent. I was in a band with Pam. We had a great time. Wasn't that fun, Pam?
It was fun. And then I had to go and have a baby.
Yeah, well, no, that was actually what stopped the band. It was Pam and Jerry Leonard on guitar, Doug Yule on drums, me on bass. And yeah, we traveled around a bit and we had a lot of fun.
It was really great. And then, you know, Stu is always a bright light. You know, he's always someone that every time you see him, he's got this big smile on his face. And just really, you felt like the solution was coming, not the problem.
Unusual solutions, you know.
There you go. And you know, people really want to be around Stu for that, you know. And I think that that's a hugely successful aspect of a person. The more I get on in life, I realize that those are the people that you're drawn to. Those are the teachers. Those are the people that you want to be around. They inspire you. They've got so much magic that they're finding, and they're sharing it along the way.
Yeah, and Pam, you have been inspiring too. I mean, there were, my last solo album, I did one of Pam's tunes. So it was a great tune called Crazy. And we've shared a lot over the years.
Evocative jazz, exotic lounge. We can only actually hope that Eric Adams, who's apparently one of five siblings raised by a single mum, house cleaner in Queens, will actually sort of open up the New York style, etc. We kind of avoided that question about what do you feel about Eric Adams taking over the role of mayor of New York. It's a big thing to us over in Europe. Who is the mayor of New York? Because you've had some clinkers in the past. What are your thoughts? I mean, are you optimistic? Do you feel this is a good one?
Oh, yeah, I think this is a good one. I think New York needs diversity. It's always been the most diverse place on the planet. I mean, where I grew up in Coney Island, and I was just there last week. You know, when you walk down the street in Coney Island, there's Russians, Jews, Catholics, Muslims, Black, White, Puerto Rican, and everybody together. So I suggest if you really wanted to see the diverse part of New York, go to Coney Island, go out on the pier to where the Fisher people are. And you will see men, women, and every nationality fishing together. That, to me, is what New York is about. It's this whole mentality of we're all in this together. We're not different people. We're all earthlings, okay? And I believe that that's really the essence of New York, that we believe we are all earthlings.
Absolutely. Whatever species the earthling happens to be, it'll be part of it. I'm sure we're connected within that. Stu, brief musical break. What's your favorite Simon and Garfunkel song?
Oh, my favorite Simon and Garfunkel song. I would have to, Sounds of Silence is good, but there's Old Friends, I would have to say. Old Friends.
Bookends theme.
Yeah, it was such a great song. And now when I hear it these days and I'm old, it's different than when I was 16 hearing it.
Stu, we don't use the O word on New York. Oh, the O. We are experientially enhanced. We are chronologically gifted. We certainly don't make use of the O word. These are critical, fundamental sort of aspects.
Sat on their park bench like bookends, a newspaper blown through the grass falls on the round toes of the high shoes of the old friends. Old friends, winter companions, the old men lost in their overcoats, waiting for the sunset. The sounds of the city sifting through trees settle like dust on the shoulders of the old friends. Can you imagine us years from today sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange to be 70. Old friends, memory brushes the same years, silently sharing the same fear.
We just heard Simon and Garfunkel and Old Friends, the book and theme. The reason I talked about Simon and Garfunkel is I believe, Sue, you shot the insert for the double album Simon and Garfunkel Live in Central Park.
I actually did. I was a photographer. I was on the road with a lot of musicians.
You got mail. You know what I'm saying?
That's the computer telling me in my own voice that I have mail.
The computer's possessed. Center and Exorcist.
Simon and Garfunkel was a funny thing because I was really very involved in being, you know, a photographer in New York City and shooting musicians. And my friend John Mathias was the actual engineer on the Simon and Garfunkel Live in Central Park. And he came to my studio the day before, 2 days before, and he showed me his little pass that he had with his picture on it that said Simon and Garfunkel. I wish I had it here.
Tom and Jerry.
Oh, I do actually have it here. I'm going to put it up.
Hey, this deserves a print scrot. There we are. Fantastic. That is Paul Simon. Okay. Looking quite tall, it has to be said. In that shot, Paul Simon looks very tall.
No, that was actually me, not Paul Simon.
Did you not think, Pamela, that actually that was Paul Simon? Who would have thought the studio still look alike for Paul Simon?
I'm going to tell you a funny story because I did. He came to my studio and showed me his pass. I said, John, I love you, but give me that pass for 10 minutes. And I photographed it and I made my own with my own picture on it. I forged this pass right here. Then I went to the show. I was on stage. I had the free backstage pass. I was shooting, sent my contact sheets to Warner. They bought 40 photos. And the booklet, the insert booklet, was all my photos. But right after the show, John was tall and blonde. I looked just like that. We walked into a bar and everybody thought we were Simon and Garfunkel. They would not believe we weren't.
Yeah. You could have said that we were actually the precursor band Tom and Jerry. You know, yeah. Not quite the same, but still out there. Yeah.
We told them we were their stunt doubles.
It's understandable.
You know, a word comes to mind, and this is a word that sums up Stu, and you know, sums up the definitely the old school New Yorker, and I think it's still true today. It's a Yiddish word, chutzpah. You have to say it with a ch, and it's very difficult to say a ch. A lot of people can. They'll say chutzpah.
It's chutzpah, Hans Hamler. Yeah. Chutzpah. Chutzpah.
Chutzpah. It means balls.
Exactly. Are we allowed to say that?
We just have. We're letting it go. Yeah, it's all right. It's understandable. Yeah. As I like to say to my students, you've got to know how to actually hustle, but not hassle. That's the line I use. Hustle, hassle.
Exactly. And living in Coney Island, I mean, you walk down the Midway, and believe me, you learn the hustle very young.
You might even do a Van McCoy version of the hustle, but that's another line entirely. Yeah,
that's for sure.
You've been on tour with Bo Diddley. You've been on tour with Meatloaf, of course. Some rock legends in terms of those sort of sequences. Was that what kind of drew you more towards a musical jazz-based thing, or has the music always literally been within you?
Well, you know, I think the music has always been in me. I don't believe when I was younger I had the confidence to actually go out and be on stage. And I discovered a talent in making print art, making painting, making photography. And you go in different directions in your life. But I think that when I got into photography, being involved in music, doing album covers, being on tour with these people was because I really wanted to be a part of the business. And, you know, being close like to Bo Diddley or Meatloaf, these people were great people on the road. They did very, very humanitarian things. And it made me just appreciate the business even more. It was really a great thing. Especially Bo Diddley, boy, he was kind of nutty.
Strange, a musician being slightly nutty. That's unusual. Yeah. There was straight down the line.
Bo used to like to live in these, or what they call efficiency hotels. Hotels with kitchens in them because he liked to cook. So he came off a show in New York at the Collinwood Hotel and he said, Studio man, do me a favor, go to Chinatown, get me some 5 pounds of blue crabs and a hammer. And I'm like, 5 pounds of blue crabs and a hammer. Okay. I do that. I come back. He has the big pot on. He's boiling the blue crabs. We put out newspapers on the table, on the floor. They come out, he throws them on the table. We start smashing them with the hammer. We're eating them. He's throwing the shells everywhere. And he goes, Stu man, I got to go to bed. He hits the bed. He goes, oh, do me a favor, clean that all up. It's like, hey, you know, it was great.
It's tough on the crustaceans because really it's just a one gig for them, basically.
Yeah.
You know, once they've actually can say, you know, what's your ambition in life if you're a crustacean? To be hit on the head by a hammer that's been ordered by Bo Diddley.
Absolutely.
You might have already answered this indirectly, but I know Pamela's always keen for the wacky New York story. Pamela, it's time for the wacky New York story PSM question.
Oh, is there a question?
There's a question. I'm framing it right now. Stu, would you think comes to mind, because I know there's not just one, but the king or queen, as it were, of wacky New York moments.
Wow, wacky New York moments.
We've waited until we got this far into the interview to actually give us time to compose ourselves, etc. But I knew Pamela had this bombshell right upon her person and she's got to deliver it.
Well, there is a lot of wacky New York moments. Actually, one that led me to probably my best gig of my life, I'd have to say. Walking down the street in New York, meeting some guy who came up to me and said, you look just like my uncle. And I'm saying, I look like your uncle. And it turned out that the guy was Paul Howard. Paul Howard is the son of Mo of the Three Stooges, the Mo. The only Mo, the supreme Mo. And we got into a conversation and he hired me and my duo partner at the time to do his wife's 75th birthday party, which was actually, I would have to say, the best gig of my life because we started playing Three Stooges tunes. Paul got up, he sang with us. The party ended at 11. Me and my partner stayed there till like 4 in the morning because he told us some of the greatest stories I've ever heard. So that was, I would say, a pretty unusual thing that happened. I could say another crazy thing from my youth, but it would be hard. Does anybody out there know what the parachute jump is in Coney Island?
You know, I have to say, my mother was born in Coney Island Hospital. I don't know if you knew that, Stu.
Really? But I live right down the block.
You know, we're probably related.
Yeah, at least from your mother, you know, something. I might be your mother's age even.
Will you tell us that the story? Is that okay, Alex? Do we have time for this? Okay.
For what? For Coney Island?
The Coney Island parachute story.
Well, there's a parachute jump in Coney Island. If you go online, you'll see it. It's this huge structure. It was originally at the World's Fair in, I think, D.C. Anyway, the parachute jump was a ride that was really a physical parachute. There were cables that went down to the ground from the top, and you were lifted up on a seat that was a piece of wood. I mean, it was like a 2x4 and a little backing and a rope that held you in.
This is not Paramount Studio Tours or Disney, is it really? This is rough and ready New York, Coney Island stuff.
We're talking 1960. Yeah. So it took you up on this this platform with a parachute above you folded, and this cable went through a ring in the middle. When you got to the top, it released you and you free fall straight down. But you didn't fly because this cable kept you in the straight line. My father took me on it when I was 7 years old. They should never have let me on. Because when we started taking off and I said to my father, I don't want to do this, which is really it's too late. I looked up, my father was white. He had me so hard, he was holding me. I'm glad he lived longer. But that was like, when you drop 14 stories in a parachute with a little 6-year-old kid on a 2x4, I guess he was more scared than I was. But anyway.
And you say British people are eccentric. I don't know what you're talking about, really.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you.
Hey, you know, there's probably a million of them. I mean, growing up in New York. Well,
it's going to be a long series, Stu, so don't worry. We'll get you back and talk about various others.
I come back anytime.
I'm fascinated to see you did a film on Soviet psychic healers in Russia, the Soviet Union. Was this in the era of Brezhnev? Was it in the era of Mikhail Gorbachev? Who were we talking about?
It was when Gorbachev and Yeltsin were vying for power. It was 1990.
So glasnost, perestroika, that was basically
all happening. And I was called by a man I did a film for in New York, and he said, we're going to Russia. It's about Russian psychic healers. We'd love you to direct. So who's going to turn down going to Russia for a month and a half?
Oh, I don't know. Alexander Solzhenitsyn wasn't that keen on Siberia, but then again.
No, he wasn't. No, but we went to Sverdlovsk. We were in Moscow, St. Petersburg. We went to Georgia, to Tbilisi, and we searched out these Soviet psychic healers. It's quite amazing, I have to say.
And were they laying hands on? Was it a case of just they were using the power of the mind? Were they actually heal? Was that the sort of response?
Well, every single one of them that we interviewed told us that they don't actually do any of the healing, that they just channel energy. But they do hands above. They don't really touch you. They just move your energy around. And there were people that were healed, that were really healed. It was pretty amazing to me to watch that.
Stu, is that available? Is there a way people can see that film?
No, because as with any film, people get crazy. And the executive producer got mad at the producer who took the masters, and they had a lawsuit, and it was 1990, and now we're in, 30 years later, and who knows where the actual footage is. So I've had a lot of experience doing films that never got produced, never got put on, finished and stuff
like that.
But
it's out there somewhere, Stu. It's out there somewhere, maybe.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is.
And the book is imminent. The book is definitely imminent.
Every book is imminent.
In terms of the website, so obviously Pamela's mentioned you're a marriage officiant as well. You've got this wonderful jazz package from that. Do you wake up in the morning and think, right, what shall I do today? I'll do this, 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 and this. Did you go where the urge, the spirit takes you? Is there a strategy? I mean, what advice would you actually have to maybe a young soul who says, I wish I could be mistaken for one of the Three Stooges' uncles one day. How can I reach that stage? You know, what advice would you actually have?
You know, I'd say to be true to yourself. You know, there's very great philosophers online. And one of the key questions is, if money were no object, this is from Alan Watts, if money were no object, what would you do? That's the way I always think of things. If money is no object, if you have no money, you have no money problems. You know, that's basically it. So I would always choose to do what makes you happy, because to spend your life in a terrible job, teaching your children to spend their lives in a terrible job, just so you can live well when you're older or have some security at some other point, we're happening right now. I've always been trying to be in the moment. And being in the moment keeps you fresh, keeps you young, keeps you creative, and open to the next thing, basically.
People who are interested, obviously, in string instruments are well aware of the Stradivarius, but I think it's time we introduce the Studivarius to the world now. Stu, would you actually explain how you've, in a sense, produced this marvelous device, marvelous instrument, the Studivarius?
Well, going back to when I had to go to the subway to make a living with a regular washtub bass, I really thought this was going to be, you know, the start of my new music career. I was tired of doing the visuals. I really, if I didn't do it then, it wasn't going to happen. And so I did have this washtub bass, and a friend of mine asked me to play in his jazz band, sort of as a novelty. It's very hard in a jazz band with a washtub bass. So even though we did a few albums, I just started to figure out we have to develop this because this has a lot of pull. You know, if I get a big bass or an electric bass, there's a billion bass players. How many single string bass players are there? Probably none. So over the last 20 years, I developed it and came up with different prototypes. And now I have a 3.5-octave single string bass that isn't kind of in demand. People want me to play in their bands, you know, and it does everything an upright does, except it's sort of like a bass with a whammy bar.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, you got mail. You know what I'm saying?
I'm getting mail.
It's wonderful. It's like having a kind of ego and super ego on the same show. You know, the kind of motion of where we're coming through on this. You got mail. Yeah. Well, you know, I do worry about the grammatical phrasing of you got mail. You have got some mail, perhaps.
Yes.
You know, mail has arrived for you, but you got mail. It's so Meg Ryan, honestly,
yeah,
Tom Hanks. You know, just step away.
Well, I got something to show you, because aside from my Studivarius, I also invent other instruments, and I just happen to have one here I'd like to show you. It's called a Flutivarius. It's a double, let's see if I could raise it. Show you this. This is a double slide whistle. I'll give you a little playing.
I mean, this is just genius stuff. I mean, I almost for a moment there thought you were into a Sousa rendition of all sorts of things, but we took something more wonderful for the whole thing.
You should hear the Three Stooges tunes on it. It's great.
Stu, will you play that on one of my upcoming songs?
Anytime you need it, Pam. You got me. You know that. I'm at your service.
The Flutivarius, the Studivarius, it's been quite frankly awesome. Another New York Real Talk begins to draw to a close. Pamela, have you got any closing thoughts you'd like to share with Studio Stu, our ace guest for this edition of NYRT New York Real Talk?
Well, there's so much more, and I'm just wondering, this preempts another question, but I really want to know if you'd come back, because I'll there's back more, anyway. There's so much more.
And, well, for sure. And I want to talk about the Studivarniškis, which is a dish that I created that's in one of my favorite restaurants in New York. So there's a lot of Studa stuff to talk about anytime.
This is excellent news. It's been awesome connecting with your good self. Studio Stu, of course, people want to get in touch with you, Stu, do you have Facebook? Do you have the usual channels? Do they simply go to studiostu.com? What's the best way to follow through on your magical world?
Well, you can go to studiostu.com. That has all my gigs, all the information about me and the Stu-tivarius. And you can go to my Instabook. I used to do Facebook, but you know I couldn't afford it, so now I do Assbook. Now, for me,
it's okay. We can let it go. It's perfectly all right.
For me, you know,
Mark Zuckerberg, remember Mark Zuckerberg, right. It's Meta. It's all about the Meta now.
Meta, right,
Facebook
right.
is so yesterday. It's the brand of Meta. We engage with the reality of the now by the metaverse.
You know, in Hebrew, Meta means death.
Exactly. I was wondering if somebody would pick up on that. But if you can make a million by basically producing a sexist line in one of the top New York universities, then why not actually go for that?
Yeah. So go to my Instagram. It's StudioStu13 or the Stu-tivarius or StudioStuArt. Check them out.
And if we had a chance, what Bo Diddley number would you like us to wrap up with?
Wow, Bo Diddley. You know what? I loved all his stuff. So just feel free and hit the button.
We'll press the button right now.
Okay. Great, Alex. Thanks.
Did it walk?